Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, has your social media use been more helpful and positive in your life lately, or has it brought some anger, maybe some frustration? Oh, man, Beth Wendt can talk with us about that. Beth Wendt is a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Over 20 years of experience, she has a love for creative problem solving. So we'll talk with her about screen time use, the ups and downs of social media, how to use Microsoft 365. Have you noticed a change in your screen time lately? Do you want to spend less time on your phone? Has social media impact you positively or negatively lately? Or maybe you're having a tech problem. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Beth Wendt, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Well, you know, lots of things to do outside the house, or maybe fewer things to do in terms of going to restaurants and so forth. But we are spending more time, at least I am, looking at screens, computers, the phones. Is there something you've noticed in your own habits or those around you?
Yeah, absolutely. For a living, stare at a screen, so it's not so different for me because I work with computers. I spend most of my workday staring at one anyway, other than under normal times. I go to meetings actually in person with people, so that's some time out of my day that's not staring at a screen. But I've noticed a lot of folks spending quite a bit more time, obviously, for work and for entertainment and for communicating with friends, family, colleagues, things like that. And there's certainly an amount of burnout going on that I'm noticing amongst my friends, family, and colleagues doing that.
Yeah, you hear these terms, virtual burnout. You hear or see Zoom fatigue, which I think I've had a little bit of that. Maybe you can talk about what exactly those terms are.
Well, you know, when we have meetings in person with folks all day long at work, we're going from place to place. We get up, we go to a different room. We walk through the office, we see others. There's this sense of movement from place to place and a break in between things. Whereas now, with a lot of us working from home, spending all of our time in virtual meetings, and then also when we want to connect with friends and family outside of our own home, we have to do the same thing. So when you're staring at a screen all day long for work, it makes you less inclined to want to get on a Zoom call with some of your friends or family members that you're not able to see right now. So I think there are a lot of things that people can do to help limit some of that fatigue that they're feeling.
Yeah. So, well, what are some of those things?
So one of the things we're talking about, especially at work, is creating meetings that don't run hour to hour. So if you have a meeting from 9 to 10 a.m. At 10 a.m., the people you were meeting with have another meeting, there's just no break in between. There's no chance for them to get up, go grab a glass of water, stretch their legs, check on their kids who may be doing online school at the time, or, whatever's necessary while you're at home. So trying to schedule a meeting maybe 45 minutes instead of an hour and leave a 15-minute break in between the folks aren't going back-to-back-to-back meetings is one of those things that I found pretty helpful. Also, we're talking about within departments potentially having no meeting days, maybe a no-meeting Friday, where we just don't schedule virtual meetings with each other, and it's a time when we can all focus on getting work done rather than the interruption, or we won't be so burned out at the end of the day that we can't have a Friday happy hour with friends online.
Yeah, those are all really good tips. I mean, I've been in situations where I've had a Zoom meeting from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, from 3 to 4. And by the end of that meeting from 3 to 4, you're kind of feeling like your butt aches from sitting for three straight hours, you just don't have the energy that you probably should have had, especially for that last meeting.
Yeah, I think the normal routine of you know, you go to a meeting in the office, you get up, you walk to a back to your office or to another conference room or to another building. You know, there's just this natural break in between when you're expected to be fully on and fully engaged. And without having any gap between those things happening, a lot of folks struggle with that switching their frame of mind from one topic to another very quickly. And if you're going from one meeting discussing one thing to another meeting discussing something entirely different without any kind of gap in between, it can really exhaust your brain.
Yeah, it can indeed. Well, I broadcast from home, and I posted a blog today just for people, a little story on blog with a couple of pictures of me broadcasting from home while one of my cat, Tiger, who likes to jump up and rub on the microphone and so forth while I'm on the air. But so I'm just going to mention that. Go to WPR.org/Larry, and you can see a photo of me at my dining room table with all my equipment. And another shot of my cat and a little story about that. So I did want to mention that today. So we're all doing things a little differently. And let's hear from you, by the way. If you have questions or comments as we're moving along, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. I want to ask you about social media. Brad, actually, in Janesville has a question relating to that, I believe. Let's go there. Brad, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I walked away from Facebook about 10 years ago just as a time saver, and I'm trying to use my Facebook account again now, but I find that it's almost impossible to contact Facebook. I reset my password successfully, but they have my account locked, and they want me to verify my identity. And they gave me this screwy set of hoops to jump through. They put before me three people from my friends list and said, contact these three people without using Facebook and ask them to send in or to click a link or what have you in order to verify that it's really you. And these are actually three people I haven't talked to in 20 years. They just pick three people randomly from my list of people. Yeah, what do I do? There's no way to contact Facebook for help.
Wow, that sounds really maddening.
Yeah, it does indeed. I wonder if you could. Well, I was just going to say, I wonder if you could just start a whole new Facebook page and eliminate the old one. That may not be what Brad wants to do, but would that be a possibility, Beth?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a possibility to start over from scratch. However, some folks would, you know, as you send out new friend requests to people who thought they already had you in their friend list, they may think that those are some sort of a dummy account or false, or somebody impersonating, you know, the person who they already thought was in their friend list. So they may be less inclined to actually accept that request, because sometimes that's how people tend to propagate some malicious activity online. So starting over from scratch might not be the most optimal way to go. And also, if you had a lot of folks in your friend group already that you don't want to have to rebuild, that's another drawback of doing it that way. But yeah, I do really empathize with the fact that some of these tech companies have very little in the way of actual in-person support. So talking to a human being and figuring out how to solve a more complex problem than their bots or their online documentation can solve for you is really difficult. I do believe Facebook has a support chat interface. I think if you go to support.facebook.com, there's a link that allows you to do some live chat support. So they may be able to point you in a direction where you could find some better instruction on how to get your account started back up, or they may then be able to give you an actual support phone number where you can talk to a human being.
Yeah, that live chat, I haven't used it for Facebook, but I have successfully used it with a number of other businesses, let's say, and have been I've had actually pretty good luck with the live chat for a variety of everything from health to airlines and so forth. So that might be worth a try, Brad. And where does he go again for that? Just go to
I believe somewhere linked somewhere on the support.facebook.com page, when they list their support contact options, generally there'll be a link on there for live chat.
Support.facebook.com. Brad, does that help?
Actually, no. I tried that, and all it did was get me to community support, and community support said that there was nothing that they could do.
Well, hopefully, hopefully you've got the emails addresses of those people you haven't talked with in 20 years. I don't know what else. Maybe somebody else has an idea or has had that same experience. Because I think Beth has pretty much covered what she thinks is the best way. Am I right there, Beth?
Yeah, I'm a little tapped out as far as that one. Those are the, you know, the two, really the two options that I would think of is either, you know, firing up a new Facebook account and starting from scratch, or being able to reach out through the live chat option with Facebook and get some better instruction on how to rekindle your account. But it's unfortunate that they make it so difficult for you to start things back up. I do understand their need to do some verification of your identity, and it doesn't sound like it's real logical how they're having you go about doing it. So that's unfortunate.
And there's no way to email them back directly, I'm sure, to say, hey, send me, I've got different friends that I can use or something. Please give me those, you know, I'll be glad to email those folks. Well, Brad, stay listening, because there may be some other people who've had the same problem and have some suggestions as well. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking today with Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at all kinds of things relating to your computer and social media with our guest, Beth Wendt, IT specialist for 20 years, works now as the senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions, give a call, 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Well, here we have our caller trying to get back into social media, get back into Facebook, but I think people out there who have are spending, maybe feeling like they're spending way too much time on social media. How do you try to make sure you're having a positive experience with social media and it's not just an addiction?
Yeah, that's a tough call to make. Initially when things started happening around coronavirus and, things were shutting down and there was a lot of change day to day, it seemed like it was really critical to keep up on the news as it was changing. And social media was a really good opportunity to see that news coming through in real time. But also, you know, it can really cause some burnout, similar to what we were talking about with virtual meetings. This inundation of constant news, especially a lot of bad news. And then also that seeming lack of trust that folks have for the sources of news that they're getting. So cutting back on what you're looking at on social media can really be helpful. One of the things that I've done to help at least give myself some more positive content rather than always seeing so much negativity was there were a couple of groups out there that that I joined that were for sharing more positive things. One of them is a group of folks local to the Madison area who work in the service industry, chefs, bartenders, wait staff, front of the house, back of the house, people who have worked in those industries over the years, all sharing pictures of the amazing food creations that they're coming up with throughout the lockdown at home. So all the crazy stuff they're cooking up and meals that they're missing, so they're trying to recreate at home, things like that. Another one that I joined was a group of folks from all over the world who post a view from their window at home. So what does it look like outside your window? And it's incredible to see, you know, what people from all over the world are looking at every day when they sit in their homes and go about their lives in such a different way than we normally did. So sharing those positive experiences has really helped me kind of reframe my relationship with social media lately.
Yeah, I noticed the Washington Post has, of course, it has its daily news feed that is all of the issues of the day, but it also has a sort of a more positive news feed as well that basically has stories, kind of nice stories about good things that are happening to people and so forth. And I find that's kind of fun to be able to watch that as well. So that's kind of fun. You know, the other thing is safety. How safe are social media? And I know you wanted to talk a little bit about that. Sometimes we hear talk about these networks sharing our data, and that can be pretty extensive.
Yeah, we have talked about that in the past, and you really have to make a calculated judgment on how much risk of your data being out there you're willing to tolerate. So, you know, anytime I sign up for a social media account on any of the platforms, be it Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or anything like that, the very first thing I do is dig directly into their security settings. And they take a look at what they're sharing, because they have to, by law, disclose that information to you. So if you create an account, there's always a settings button that you can go to on your main social media page. If you go into those settings and take a look at the security settings, you can see what type of data they're going to be sharing. You can opt out of certain types of data sharing, or you can choose who that data is shared with. You can also really restrict who can see what you post on social media. So if you want to be very careful about what gets out there in the world, I would say be diligent about looking at those sharing and privacy settings within each social media platform that you sign up for.
Yeah, it's really, I once posted, not a couple of weeks ago, I think, or maybe 3 weeks ago, I was checking online and I looked at some swimsuits, now I'm inundated. Every time I go online, it seems like down the right-hand side, I get a whole thing of men and women in various swimsuits. Even though
I
didn't
be careful what you Google, it might mess up your algorithm, and then you'll see some interesting ads popping up.
Yeah. And it's like, I would love to get rid of those ads. Could I go back into my settings now and change that?
So are you saying you're seeing these ads in showing up in like Facebook, things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you absolutely can. In those security and privacy settings, there are settings for basically customizing the advertising experience that you that comes through to your account.
I will do that.
Yeah, if you don't want to see, you know, a bunch of people in swimsuits on your Facebook feed, I would say go for it. All I see is motorcycles on mine right now because I was Googling motorcycles, so I don't mind.
Amy and Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Oh, sure. I wanted to comment about the guy who said he wanted to get back on Facebook, or he wanted to redo his account. I deleted my Facebook a few years ago, actually 2016, because I couldn't stand the politics. So I got off it. It took me 3 months before they would actually delete my account. Then I had to go back on because I'm a member of a group that needs me to post pictures to the Facebook page. So I got back on just specifically for that. And what happened is I looked at a couple friends, old friends, at their pages and stuff, and I discovered that it's either kittens or horrible misinformation about coronavirus or endless politics. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to tell this guy. Was it Brian?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, save yourself the heartache. just stay off it because it's going to end up being the same time suck it was before. And this particular year in 2020, it's only going to get nastier. So for my money, I would say just stay off it, love your life, and keep in touch with the people you really want to keep in touch with. And
Amy, thanks for calling. Well, Beth, that's one approach.
Absolutely.
No reason you can't do that. Tom in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I have a question about Google and other browsers. Is there any way to get information off about yourself off of Google?
How do you remove?
Like when you Google yourself?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So there's a number of different ways you can go about that, and it really depends on information where the information is posted. So when you Google yourself, the sites that come up, they do so based on some specific algorithms that are out there. The first page that will come up that has your information on it generally is what will perpetuate other sites to show that information as well. If there's a way to contact the owner of the site that shows your information first, to reach out to them to have them remove it, there are ways to go about that legally. It all depends on what kind of information it is and who owns the website that's posting it. Another method that I've heard of to kind of help with this, though, that doesn't require you to try to coerce somebody else into removing information from the internet is to flood the internet with other information about you that will bury whatever you don't want seen. And a lot of folks do that kind of in the public relations world. So joining a bunch of groups that will publish your name, setting up a website for yourself that has your information on it, and then doing something called search engine optimization, which often you'll have to pay for a service to kind of boost your site when your name is Googled. There are also public relations companies that will do all this for you, but that can get pretty expensive. So a lot of times once something is out there on the internet, it is very, very difficult to get it removed. So I do wish you luck with that.
Yeah. Google myself there are hundreds of pages. Of course, many of them relating to Wisconsin Public Radio, but there's a ton. And I think if anybody does Google themselves, they'll probably find out they're just like me, and they have a whole bunch of pages and pages of data on us. By the way, you can. Thanks, Tom, for calling. I appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Saw an interesting piece in the Washington Post about the Internet is kind of spying on us. And it's not only the computers that we have at home, but you look at it. You look at cars, your own car, for example, or, you know, going online to retailers and so forth. But even your automobile, and your fitness tracker, and so schools and so forth, all have data on you. Can you talk about the data? Just for example, I'm thinking about cars. You know, your car has a computer, and if you sync your phone somehow to your car, right away you're going to have a lot of information. But even if you don't, the car has a lot of information that it reports back to where you bought the car from if it's a new car. Am I right on that?
It's true. There are so many devices now collecting various data points on us that often we're not even really aware of, that those data points are not just being collected, but then being aggregated and shared and sold, bought and sold between corporations. So, and it also is not a stretch to think that there are also government agencies that are collecting some of that information. And, you know, we never know how that's going to be used or, you know, what kind of liberties are going to be taken with that data. So knowing what you're getting into is really important. I just bought a scale recently, just a regular bathroom scale. And there were all these options for a connected scale so that it could sync to your smartwatch, which will sync to your phone, which will track your BMI and all of your vital statistics and things like that. And, you know, I had to think long and hard before I chose the product that I did, because I had to think about, well, what information did I want this thing to collect? Who did I want that information shared with? And what kind of consequences are there of that information being out there outside of my doctor's hands? So it's really about educating yourself.
Yeah, it is indeed. Let's go to Peter in Stoughton next. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. I've had a generally positive experience with Facebook over the years. They've done some things to me that are very, very frustrating, and they continue to do that. But it's become a surprisingly important part of my existence. I have about 200 friends, 150 of which I've never actually physically met, but they're from all parts of the globe. And this whole, the recent couple of months has kind of brought us all together even more closely. And then there's the other aspect of, well, for instance, I lost my wallet a couple of weeks ago for about 20 minutes. And I went back to Walmart where I last used it. And yeah, it had been turned in by one of their employees who found it in the entranceway. And so I put a post on Facebook in a Stoughton neighborhood group, thanking this person and just generally expressing my appreciation. And 2 weeks later, that post has gotten like 280 likes. And it also led to a conversation with a whole bunch of other people, well, a whole bunch of other posts following mine up saying, yeah, this is where we live. This is a great town. And so it kind of had the dual aspect of I was able to express my appreciation, and it also allowed a lot of other people to also express their appreciation. So, yeah, Facebook really, really hurts me sometimes, but most of the time it gives me a place where I can be useful and other people can be useful to me.
Oh, Peter, thanks so much for calling. Beth, a comment from you.
No, I do think there are so many opportunities for us to make the world feel a bit smaller and to make us feel more connected to each other, especially under the current circumstance using social media. So it's definitely not all bad. And I think most folks' intentions on social media are not to misinform or to do something that's bad.
Yeah, this morning that blog appeared this morning on my WPR.org/Larry, the post that I made about hosting a show from home, and I posted it up on my Facebook page, and I think I've already gotten some nice comments from folks, so it can be a positive experience, as Peter says. Appreciate it, Peter. Thank you. Jean from Sun Prairie emailed that she had a similar problem accessing the Facebook account that hasn't been used in a few years. Jean says Facebook will send a code to change the password 5 to 7 days after making a request, but it never works. She wants to close the account, but doesn't know if there's a way to do that without being able to log in. Also thinking if it's hard to gain access for the actual account owner, do I really have to worry about anybody else getting in there to hack it? Good question. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, well, if the account is disabled, then nobody's going to be able to get in to hack it, so it's safe. I do think that they make the process pretty onerous to fire them back up once they've been deactivated completely. So there's a difference between disabling and deactivating your account. When you disable it, your profile remains. However, it's not visible to those in the outside world, and you can basically flip a switch and turn it back on. But when you deactivate, you're actually removing all record and kind of giving back that space. So your account itself becomes defunct. So reanimating it from there is much more difficult than if you just disable.
John emailed with a tech question, wants to know if he's wasting his time attempting to install Windows 10 using a working key, or if he should bite the bullet and pay for a Windows 10 Ultimate Disk. He says he's currently running into an issue that says Windows 10 will not work with current graphics card. He has an HP Pavilion laptop.
Yeah, it's very possible that the card that he has in his laptop that there aren't what's called drivers within Windows 10 that will run that piece of hardware. So what drivers are is basically a piece of software that tells the operating system of your computer, in this case Windows 10, how to handle the piece of hardware, in this case the graphics card, how to work. And if there is not a driver or that piece of communication software that's compatible with both Windows 10 and your graphics card, you're not going to be able to install the actual Windows product. So it may be that you need to put a new graphics card in your laptop, which sometimes isn't possible, or it may be time to upgrade your laptop entirely to something new if you want to be able to use Windows 10.
So how do you update your graphic card in your computer?
If you have a tower, you can buy a new one. They sell them at major electronics stores online. I know Madison Computer Works in town carries them. You would want to do some research to know what type you would need for the type of computer you have. So you need to do a little bit of kind of sleuthing to figure out which type of hardware you need, which type of graphics card, a computer case isn't too tough to crack open and take the old one out and put the new one in. But if you aren't as technically inclined, you can always take it to a shop to have that done. So like I said, Madison Computer Works sells those parts. They also do those hardware swaps if necessary.
Jane emailed with a question about Microsoft 365. Is there some way to automatically save files to both Microsoft 365's OneDrive and her PC at the same time? She says, now files aren't showing up in OneDrive on my File Explorer page, so I can't really attach them to emails, which I need to do for work. I have to copy, copy to my PC in a separate step, and sometimes have to hunt around to see where the files have gone. Any suggestions there?
Yeah, actually, you can map OneDrive the same way you would a network drive. I'm not going to go into the specific details on how to do that on here because it's a little bit of a process. But if you were to Google OneDrive, mapping or OneDrive, HD mapping, something to that effect, it'll pull up a list of instructions for you to be able to map that as an actual drive so that your computer will see it the same way it would see the local hard drive on your computer.
All right, there we go. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Number to call again, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today on the Ideas Network, talking a bit about social media with our guest, Beth Wendt. who is the senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, one of them, and she loves to find creative solutions to problems. IT or tech question? Give us a call. Maybe you've got a question about social media. Number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And caller online, Dorian in Greene County, Wisconsin, will give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes. A while ago, I was playing some of Zingot games. I think it was hosted through Facebook. And part of the game was you try to form friendships and send out friend requests. And I was going through playing the game, and I happened to send out a friend request to somebody I really didn't know because I was only playing the game. And then they turned around and said I was harassing people by sending out friend requests and suspended my account. And I, at that point, I just decided I'm not going to play their game. I bowed out, and I haven't gone back to social media since.
Hmm. Is that a typical thing that can happen? Now, here's the situation where Dorian was playing a game that supposedly sort of advertised, well, here's a chance for making some friends. And then when he asked, he was shut out of it.
that's an unfortunate thing.
What?
A lot of those Zynga games, that's part of their, I guess, marketing strategy is part of the game is to invite other folks to join the game. And I know a lot of people get very annoyed by those friend requests from games because they pop up in your feed and they send you a notification. And if one or more of those folks that you had invited, even inadvertently, reported you for doing it, sometimes Facebook will take the action of suspending your account for harassment if somebody reported it in that manner. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you did, but Facebook takes those, you know, those claims pretty seriously, although they're not often accurate about it.
Hmm. Thanks, Dory. And Mike in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I recently finally went to Windows 10. I hesitated for a long time because I had heard and read so many problems that people have. Not really that the system didn't work. It's just the way that it wants to work. It wants to get so deeply into your operating system and into your email and into your browser. And I want to divorce myself totally from the cloud and from OneDrive so that I can get at the files on my computer anytime, any place. If I'm on a cruise ship or if I'm in Turkey or wherever I happen to be, I want to be able to get at my files. So I would welcome any and all suggestions on how to divorce myself from OneDrive in the cloud.
Hmm. What do you think, Beth?
Well, so there's a little bit of contradiction here. So if you want to be able to get to your files from wherever you are in the world, the cloud is actually an advantageous tool for that. So something like OneDrive, which stores your data in a data center that Microsoft owns that is accessible from any internet-connected browser device wherever you are, no matter what machine you're on. So you wouldn't have to bring your laptop with you to be able to do that. If you were storing all your files locally, you have to have that piece of equipment in order to access those files, or you have to have it networked in a way where you can access it from something else. But if you're entirely opposed to using any cloud resources and all of the subscription-based services that Windows 10 offers, mainly that's offering it through Office 365 or through Microsoft 365, those are things that you can uninstall from Windows so that it no longer tries to default you to storing things there. If you go into the control panel and then the programs and features, there'll be a list of all the programs that are installed. And if one of them is Office 365 or Microsoft 365, you can do an uninstall from there, and that should stop Microsoft from, or Windows 10 from trying to move your data there.
There you go, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you manage something called Microsoft 365 for the University of Wisconsin. Talk a bit more about that. What is it and what you do?
Okay, well, what I do is I work with a team that delivers Microsoft 365 services to campus. So Microsoft 365 is a suite of services, including things like email and instant messaging. There are options for voice over IP, so telephone systems. It also includes the whole Microsoft application suite, so things like Word and Excel and PowerPoint are included in that. And really, depending on the subscription level that you go with, there are different applications that come with each. There are some that are much more geared on business use. There are some that are much more geared towards student or home use. And then there are others that are more small business oriented or enterprise corporate level or large education institution, which is what I manage. So what our team does is kind of manages those applications for campus so that they're useful tools for us. It's one thing to buy a service from Microsoft and tell your users they can log in and use it. It's a whole other thing for a large institution like the University of Wisconsin to manage productivity and collaboration tools like that. So using them as an independent person at home is very different from using them in a large corporate or organizational environment.
Yeah, but this is something that people might have for their own personal use as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, they'll have especially the Office suite of applications. So I'm sure a large percentage of folks who are doing any kind of office type work are using Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel or PowerPoint or all of those tools. Those all come in the Office 365 suite, which is a kind of a subgroup of Microsoft 365, which is very confusing.
It can be indeed. Bill and Racine, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Basically, I have a Dell, you know, it's a couple of years old, maybe 3 years. It does have a Windows 10. But what happened to me was basically I tried to install or update Java and I had a problem with it. So I went back and used the restore point to go back a couple of days when I knew the computer was working okay. And what happened was I'm getting a message from Java, and it basically states, Java can't determine a valid Java home. And I don't really understand what that is. And I tried to, I do have Java on the system, at least it seems that way. And I'm just kind of perplexed by that message.
So it's telling Bill that he doesn't have a Java home.
Well, that's a new one. I wasn't sure Java had a home. It sounds to me like when you ran the installer to do the update that something may have corrupted or didn't install properly. And when you went back to the restore point, something may have gone wrong with how that Java application was reset. I would suggest doing a full uninstall of Java and then doing a fresh reinstall of it from the restore point that you're at now.
And how do you uninstall and then reinstall?
Same way that I was talking about earlier with getting rid of the Office 365 applications. If you go into the control panel in Windows 10, there's a programs and features section, and that will lead you to a kind of a wizard type click through where you can choose the applications that you want to uninstall from your computer. And then to reinstall it, you could go back to where you download it from, download a fresh copy of the installer, and then run that file to reinstall it.
Okay, Bill, does that help?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to give that a try. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Awesome.
Appreciate the call. Well, a listener emailed with a question about a pre-built gaming PC they bought a while back. The specs were relatively new, but at a closer look, the motherboard was from a specific manufacturer, so it only takes specific RAM. The listener is wondering if it would be better to replace the motherboard or if it'd be better to look into what RAM would fit in.
Yeah, replacing a motherboard is no joke. That's really the kind of the backbone of your system. So in order to replace that, you have to take all of the other components off of the motherboard and reinstall them on a new one. And then you have to worry about whether or not the components you had are going to be compatible with the new motherboard that you put in. So it's a tricky process, not something I would really invest the time in doing. It probably would serve you better just to find the right type of memory, RAM, to put on that motherboard. It'll probably save you a ton of money and time to do it that way instead.
Yeah, that makes sense. Give a call with your questions or comments, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I know people using older versions of Microsoft Office or something similar. What have been some big changes they've made in recent years with Microsoft Office?
Yeah, well, Microsoft Office used to be, a disk that you would go buy at Best Buy. So you'd go purchase, or it would come already pre-installed on your computer when you bought it. But it was a program that was a one-time install. If you wanted a new version of it, generally you had to buy a new version every time. And it was fairly expensive in that format, where you'd have to spend, anywhere between $150 to $200 to buy the whole suite. And then the next time you wanted a new version, you'd have to spend the same thing. And one of the major changes they've made in the last few years is to change Office to a subscription service rather than a single installer service. And what that means is you pay an annual fee for the licensing rights to the software. You also get multiple installs of that software with the license that you purchase. So whereas when you used to buy it, you'd buy a CD and it would come with a license key that you would put in, and that would be a one-time use license key. You'd have to register it, and you could only use that piece of software on one computer. But with the new subscription service, you can buy one subscription and install that suite of tools on up to 5 computers. So if you've got multiple devices at home that you want to use Office on, you don't have to buy 5 copies of it anymore. So that's really saving folks a lot of money.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. Jim in Winnebago County has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Larry. I have a problem with trying to do a wireless network between my home and an outbuilding that's 240 feet away. I've got a complete amped wireless system that has caused me nothing but trouble for more than a year. It's 240 feet from the access point to the building, and I've called tech support that I've paid for, and it just cannot work for very long. It just gets dropped forever. I'm wondering if I'm going to have to bury an underground cable from the house to that building.
Hmm. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, 240 feet is a pretty long distance to get a Wi-Fi signal to travel successfully. I know they do make repeaters out there that you can set up that will amplify your Wi-Fi signal, but you would need a place to put that somewhere in between where your Wi-Fi router is and where your building that you're trying to get to would be. So you need a secure location to kind of bridge in between the two buildings. 240 feet, and depending on what's in between those two buildings, it's going to be real difficult to get a Wi-Fi signal from a single router to successfully travel that far with any kind of bandwidth that's going to be useful. You're going to have so much signal loss that it's going to get real slow.
Yeah.
As far as putting in cable, if you're looking at like burying some Cat5 Ethernet cable, about 300 feet is the longest you can run that without losing signal strength as well. So if you're going to do that, I would look at something like Cat8. That's the latest version of Ethernet cable that's out. It has a longer range and less signal loss. So that it definitely is an option, and you may have to go with that if you don't have a place to put a repeater.
Yeah. Jim, have you tried repeaters?
Yeah, we've got a repeater. This thing is supposed to be good for like a quarter mile or something like that. I mean, I've got every device under the sun here that Amped Wireless sells, but it just doesn't work. And the latest is that when I connect the access point, I lose internet access throughout the house.
Oh, that's a great feature. I would say one suggestion on that Amped Wireless device. If it's dual band, if you're trying to get your signal strength to go further, use the lower megahertz band rather than the higher megahertz band, because the higher megahertz band will give you more bandwidth but less signal strength. The lower one will push your signal further, so that's one option you can try.
Well, give that a try, Jim, before you do anything else, but otherwise maybe underground cable is in your future. Oh, boy. Beth Wendt, our guest today, she is the senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back with Beth. So you stay with us. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you with us. Beth Wendt is our guest today. She's Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her back. We're talking about managing your screen time, some of the positive and negative sides to social media, taking a number of IT questions. Maybe you've got something that you're experiencing with your computer that you'd like to get resolved, if it's at all possible. Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have caller Joanne from Green Bay up next. So let's go to Joanne. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, Joanne. What can we do for you?
About 4 years ago, I got an application called Dropbox. That's where you save files. And that was before the iCloud. Well, then the iCloud came along, and I really liked the iCloud. Meanwhile, Dropbox is saying, your Dropbox is almost full. You know, we're going to eliminate some files. Well, I'd love to get rid of the files, but I think if I do, wherever those files are in my computer, it also gets rid of them there. And I want to keep some of the files, but I don't know how to get them off Dropbox without also accidentally getting them off my computer.
Okay. Beth, how does Joanne go about doing that?
There actually is a way to download files from Dropbox local to your computer. So the stuff that you wanted to keep, you could actually just download those from your Dropbox that's up in the cloud to your local drive. And then if you wanted to move those over to iCloud, you could upload those to iCloud. But there are also ways that you can move things directly from Dropbox to iCloud and just use a little Google search, move Dropbox to iCloud, and a whole bunch of instructional knowledge-based articles came up on the proper way to do that. So you can either move them over directly, or you can download them directly to your machine and then upload them wherever you want to move them in the future.
Okay, so just go to Google and put in move Dropbox to iCloud?
Yeah, that's what I Googled, and it came up with a whole bunch of various methods for doing that depending on what kind of computer you're on. You'd want to use the one specific for you. If you're on an Apple, there's instructions for how to do it on a Mac. And then there's also instructions for how to do it on a Windows-based machine.
All right. There you go, Joanne. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to John in Onalaska. Hi, John.
Hi. I just finished a large PowerPoint presentation that has many photographs in it. And I'd like to send this to my friend in Africa. How would I do that? I it was so many pictures, I think I don't think I can do it on email, can I?
Probably not the best way to try. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, so sending something with a lot of pictures in it often can create a really large file. And depending on what type of email system you're using, some of those systems will have a limit on the file size that you can send. So you're right about trying to send something like that via email might not be the best method for transmitting it. What I would do is use something like Google Drive or Dropbox that we were just talking about, or Box is another service. One of these cloud-based storage services, Google is one that's especially handy because it's a free service. You get a pretty decent amount of storage, and it's very easy to sign up for and to share things via the service. So if you had a large file like that in PowerPoint and you wanted to share it with your friends, you can sign up for a Google account, create a Google Drive, and then upload your PowerPoint presentation to that Google Drive, and it's sitting out there in storage. And then Google gives you the option to create a link to share that access so that anyone you send that link to and then click on it, it'll take them to your Google Drive and give them only access to that file that you shared the link for. So it's a really secure way to share large files like that. And you can do a similar thing with things that are just photos using Google Photo. But since this is a PowerPoint, you would want to use Google Drive for it.
All right, John, does that help?
Yeah, very, very, very good. Thank you.
All right, appreciate your call. Lauren from Madison emailed with a couple of questions. First, she audits courses at UW-Madison, and when classes went exclusively online in April, she was unable to connect to BB Collaborate to complete the course. She accessed the course site in her UW account, but then the screen would just sit there attempting to connect, even if waiting 20 minutes. This happened all of the four times she tried. She contacted DoIt, I guess, and was told to clear her cache. She says she does that regularly, and even after following the directions, still couldn't get in. She says she was able to use BB Collaborate successfully for a few UW Extension courses during April, so isn't sure that cache is the problem.
So I'm going to put in a plug for our help desk here at DoIt. It sounds like you contacted them first when you were having issues, and they gave you some instructions on how to try to clear that. If it didn't work, I would absolutely recommend following up with the help desk at DoIt. You should have a case number that they gave you when you called them initially. You can follow up with that same case number. And if the instructions that they're giving you to be able to access what you need don't work, they can escalate that case then to the team in Academic Technologies, which supports software like Blackboard Collaborate. So our help desk will get you to the right folks to help you with your problem if they're not able to do it for you.
All right. Her second question is related to Microsoft 365, which she just upgraded to. She says since downloading it, she's had multiple problems with Word. If the Word document is open with no activity, even for only a few minutes, the program locks up and she has to use Control-Alt-Delete to stop the task. What could be the problem there?
Well, that could be any number of things. It could be a problem with the application itself and how it was installed. There may be some sort of file corruption within there, and doing the uninstall and reinstall that we talked about with a couple of other applications may be helpful. It also could be a problem with the computer itself. If it's running out of memory or processor cycles to be able to run the application, if there are multiple other applications running at the same time, it may be using up all of the resources of the computer, and it's going to choose one to kind of freeze up or shut down. There also could potentially be some malicious software on the system causing things to freeze up and crash. And running a virus scan software program and also a malware scanning program to see if it comes up with any potentially fishy viruses or malware programs that may be causing problems.
Yeah, all good points. So good luck with that, Lauren. Appreciate your email there. You can call in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your computer question or problem, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Google offers, as you've talked about a little bit, their own similar version of the Microsoft programs, Google Drive, its Docs, Sheets, Slides. What are some of the difference between what Google has and what Microsoft has?
Yeah, Google is a little bit more of a stripped-down version of what Microsoft produces, and not in the sense that it's worse. It's just a little bit more simplified for use, and I find the user interfaces within Google to be a little bit more intuitive than some of the Microsoft stuff. So I do like using it. I use it frequently. You have Gmail, which I'm sure most people know about, which is kind of their answer to Outlook, Microsoft's email interface. You have the Google Drive that I was talking about for remote cloud storage, which is really handy for sharing files or being able to access your files from whatever device you're on. There's Google Photo. That's something that I use to basically back up the photos that I take on my phone. I have an app, a Google Photo app on my phone that synchronizes all of the photos that I take up to the cloud so that if something happens to my phone, I don't lose all my photos. There is Google Meet, which is very similar to WebEx or Zoom or all of the other virtual face-to-face conferencing and chat applications that are out there. Google Meet is very easy to use and it functions very well. And most of these services are offered free when you sign up for a Google account. Now, free within certain limitations, you maybe don't get as much data storage or, there are certain limits on things if you're not using a paid account. But it's a really great free option. And then they also have their version of Word, Google Docs, and Google Sheets would be the equivalent of Microsoft Excel. Both of those are simplified versions of what you would see in the Microsoft suite. So fewer features, but very easy to use and easy to collaborate with other people on because most other folks can access those without having to buy a license for Microsoft.
Yeah, I wondered on Google Meet, if you're going to, let's say, somebody that doesn't have Google, can you still have a Meet with somebody if you do?
The Google Meet, I believe, you can only use if you have a paid license. There's Google Chat, which you can use with a free license that does have some of the video features, but it's a little bit different.
Okay.
So you can do like video calling like you would on FaceTime. Through Google Chat, you can't do the large, like, multiple people conferences like you can with Google Meet.
Let's go to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I got a couple questions. I'd like to know what the extension .dll, Delta, lazy. And I also have a Windows 10 laptop, a Lenovo ThinkPad, but I don't have Microsoft Word. I have LibreOffice or LibreWriter, but I can't seem to email anything from that app on this Windows 10 operating system. I just wonder if it had the operating system had anything to do with it.
Okay. So, the first one, the DLL, that's Dynamic Link Library is what it means, and it's really a back-end file. It's something that applications use in order to configure and integrate with other parts of your operating system. It's not a file you would ever open and look at or use for anything, but it is something that's critical for some application on your machine to use.
Okay.
And then the second question you asked, I didn't quite hear the email service that you're using. So if you could repeat that, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, LibreOffice and LibreWriter, but I can't seem to email anything from with the Windows 10 operating system. It says that it instructed me to go to default control panel, but I couldn't find anything by that name on my laptop.
I see. Okay. So it's probably looking for you to set up the mail account there's a mail control panel So if you go to your start menu in Windows, and there's a little like a gear looking icon on the left hand side of it, your settings button. That takes you into a Windows settings control panel. And from here, there should be one called Mail that you can get into and configure your mail account for the type of service that you're using. Actually, it looks like it's called Accounts now under Windows 10 instead of Mail. So if you go into the Accounts section of that, there should be an Email and Account option on the left side. And you can go in and add your email service so that you can use that mail application.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Let's go to Keith in Green Bay next. Hi, Keith.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have Windows 7 on my computer, and, of course, that's not supported anymore. Does it make sense to upgrade to Windows 10, and how would I do that, and how expensive is that?
What do you think, Beth? Is it possible for Keith to go from Windows 7 to Windows 10?
I don't think that there is a way to upgrade direct from Windows 7 to Windows 10. I don't think there's a... So sometimes with Windows versions, you can install an upgrade, and you don't have to do a full rebuild of the operating system, and that's a really simpler way to go from one version to the next. But when you're skipping versions, going from 7 to 10, you're skipping over Windows 8, which I don't blame you for skipping over because Windows 8 was pretty terrible. I don't believe that there is a direct upgrade path from 7 to 10. So depending on the age of your machine, it may not be able to run Windows 10. So I would do some compatibility checks on the model of hardware that you're running and Windows 10 to make sure that it's compatible. If it is, then you're likely going to have to buy a fresh copy of Windows 10 on disk. And usually that runs, depends on which version you get, but in the $100 range.
All right. There you go, Keith. Thank you very much for calling. Phil in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, I actually had a suggestion for the previous caller that was having an issue with the wireless access point dropping out. What you really kind of need to look for is like an antenna that's like directional, at least like omnidirectional, and then just have that attached to your access point.
Beth, well, it sounds like that might work. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I believe that the system the fellow was talking about already has an omnidirectional antenna on it, but I'm not certain. But those can really help boost your signal. I have one with three omnidirectional antennas on it, and my Wi-Fi signal works real well all over my house. So those are certainly helpful.
All right. There we go. Phil, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. A little time left. You can join in 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, I was thinking back to that Washington Post article, and one of the suggestions that it had, if you prefer that your internet searches stay private, they suggest browse with Firefox because its privacy controls are stronger than other of the big name browsers. Or they mentioned DuckDuckGo as an alternative service you can easily set as your default search partner at DuckDuckGo.com. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know much about DuckDuckGo. That's a newer service, and I've just started hearing about it recently. And Firefox does have pretty robust security settings. Mozilla, the company that manufactured that, is pretty stringent about the security settings they put in. I'm not sure that it would be any that much better than something like Chrome. It's certainly going to be better than Internet Explorer. I wouldn't recommend using that at all. The one thing I would say about either Chrome or Firefox is they have what's called incognito browsing mode or private browsing mode. You can turn that on within the settings of either of those applications. If you turn that on, then your web traffic is not tracked by the websites you're hitting. You show up anonymously. There aren't cookies then stored on your machine from those sites. It doesn't track your browsing history. It's a nice thing to do if you don't want any of your data collected while you're browsing, but it does kind of inhibit some of the nicer features of like, you go to Google something that you Googled once before, and Google will autofill that out normally. If you're in private browsing, it won't do that.
Sean in Franksville, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I made an audition video on my Chromebook. And unbeknownst to me, the Google puts them into MK4 format. And when I tried to send it, they only accepted MP4s. So I downloaded VLC, which is supposed to be a converter. Mm-hmm. In fact, I downloaded two instances of it, and neither one of them had a pull-down menu. And I thought, does Chromebook's version of VLC not able to do that?
Yeah, I've never used VLC on a Chromebook. I've only used it on a Windows machine. It's possible that the Chromebook doesn't have the ability to convert to MP4 or store MP4 files. But likely there is an online service that you can convert the file through. Usually you can go to like online video file converter, Google something like that. There'll be a service where you can upload the file to be converted, and then you can send it from there.
All right, there you go, Sean. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Beth, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. You're back on July 13th. Jesse LeGru will be back on July 13th, but you'll be following him up. Thanks again for being with us.
Great. Thanks, Larry. Take care.
Beth Wendt is senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her with us. Always fun to talk about these IT things. Boy, they can be maddening, can't they? Ugh. Well, just to look ahead, tomorrow on the show, we're going to focus on health and diabetes. First, we'll talk with a doctor all about diabetes and managing your own diabetes. At 11:45, we'll talk about how to eat well living with diabetes. So I hope you can join us for that. Would you like to learn more about our guests or show topics? Check out our blog. And in fact, I mentioned earlier a new post out there today talking about how I'm hosting this show during the pandemic from home. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. A lot of things going on right now that affects our daily lives. And on this show, we focus on how to make your life better every single day. The morning show, Central Time, they keep us up to date on breaking stories. So stay with us on the Ideas Network for talk and news that keeps you informed and learning throughout the day. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.